Thank you, Junior, and thank you to all of you for coming out tonight. We pulled into the parking lot, and Karen said, "Those are some tough Presbyterians." So, yeah, you know, a little sprinkle in Southern California where I taught for 20 years, and that was it. No one's going out. So thank you for coming out. And happy October. I love October. It's still October. Tomorrow's Reformation Day, so I don't know about your neighborhood, but in our neighborhood, kids dress up as Martin Luther and go around and nail the 95 Theses to, they don't really. I've always loved October. I grew up in Massachusetts, where we do it right. And then I moved to California. And just since our theme for the last month or so has been sorrow or apathy or melancholy, let me give you a little personal testimony about my melancholy in Southern California. The calendar turned to October, but it didn't look like October. When I got there for my first year, it was still 90 degrees. The leaves weren't changing color. How can you tell? And for the first five, at least, years that it was October and I was in California, I would just go into a little bit of a funk. I mean, it was real melancholy. And Karen's like, snap out of it, you know? And eventually, after a few years, I finally started getting used to the fact that the leaves won't change. It's not going to be cold. Californians have no clue of what apple cider is. They think it's like the stuff you get in the little juice boxes with an apple on it. They just have no idea. And then usually by November, I was recovering sufficiently. So it was mid-November or so. And then I could recover enough to tell my students what they were missing. And so I'd wax poetic about autumn in New England, how there's just a month, there's a week in October when suddenly the leaves, just all of them together, burst out into different colors. It's just an explosion of reds and oranges and yellows. It's a little different here. Like, some trees have decided to lose their leaves already, and some haven't even decided to change. But in New England, it's just like, boom, all of a sudden, there it is. It's just this full, glorious color. And the temperature starts to dip, and you get those cool evenings, and there's certain fragrances that come in the air. And it's just the leaves changing. People start burning their wood fires. People start baking things with cinnamon, and it's just fresh in the air. And then, of course, the leaves fall, right? They get brown, they land, and the sound of the crunching leaves under your feet is just beautiful. And even the bare trees up against that dusk blue in New England, I've never seen that color anywhere else except in New England, this dusky blue sky and the bare trees silhouetted against it, it is just beautiful. And I know at that point, it's almost Thanksgiving. And in Southern California, the only way I knew it was almost Thanksgiving was that I was going to lecture on Hitler and Stalin, and it's really not the same thing. So I am thankful to be in a place where you have October, and the leaves change, and you know what autumn is. I'm also very thankful tonight that I am not lecturing on Hitler or Stalin. So, whew, right? Okay. The title of this series is Saints, Sorrows, and the Psalms. And tonight, I would like to focus on C.S. Lewis's greatest expression of sorrow, A Grief Observed, which is published in 1961. In our current sermon series on apathy, Pastor Tim mentioned some causes of acedia, one of which was unresolved grief. Lewis started writing A Grief Observed to resolve his grief, or at least to begin working toward a resolution. Following the death of his wife, Joy Davidman, who passed away in July of 1960, Lewis filled notebooks with his thoughts on grief, not intending for them to be published. That means it was a kind of catharsis for him. and it allowed him to be fully honest about what and how he was feeling. When he ran out of notebooks, that was the end of the project. He decided he wouldn't buy any more notebooks so that he could write down anything about his grief. He wrote, "If I don't stop writing at quite some quite arbitrary point, there's no reason why I should ever stop." Of course, the notebooks were published as a book, but under a pseudonym. If you look up here, it's not C.S. Lewis, it's N.W. Clerk. He chose that name as his pseudonym so that nobody would know that he had written them. He didn't want to draw attention to himself, and he was also a little concerned that his fame might actually detract from what he was trying to accomplish, which was simply to help other people to work through grief. So he wrote this and expressed his grief in it without any kind of self-censorship. He also disguised his wife's name, Joy, and just called her in the book H, which was the initial of her real first name, which was Helen. So it's Helen Joy. So N.W. Clerk wrote a book about how he had lost and how he was grieving his wife, H. The anonymity worked so well that Lewis actually had a friend of his give him a copy of the book and say, "This might help you through the grief." Now, it's not surprising that Lewis would turn to writing as a way of working through his grief. More than 40 years earlier, during the First World War, he had written to a friend of his, Arthur Greaves, and he said, "Whenever you are fed up with life, start writing. Ink is the great cure of all human ills, as I have found out long ago." And a grief observed itself, he wrote, "I must have some drug, and reading isn't a strong enough drug now. By writing it all down," all? "No, one thought in 100, I believe I get a little outside it." So writing was his drug, it was his cure as he was working through his grief. The book stands out in Lewis's writing, especially in his nonfiction. From Lewis, we expect a reasoned, methodical, logical, rational argument making some point about the Christian faith. His other works have a spiritual and theological confidence in them. They're bold assertions of Christian truth. A grief observed is deeply personal. It is an outpouring of unfiltered emotions, and it reveals a crisis of faith. It's a really hard book to read. At least I found it a really hard book to read. It has been described as raw, brutal, brutally honest, distressing and disturbing, black, bleak, and emotionally naked. In the book, Lewis feels abandoned by God. One of the central questions raised in the first chapter is, where is God? "When you are happy, so happy," he wrote, "that you have no sense of needing him, so happy that you are tempted to feel his claims upon you as an interruption, if you remember yourself and turn to him with gratitude and praise, you will be, or so it feels, welcomed with open arms. But go to him when your need is desperate, when other help is vain, and what do you find? A door slammed in your face, and a sound of bolting and double bolting on the inside. After that, silence." The comfort from God that he felt following a friend's death a few years earlier was nowhere to be found. "I have begged to be given even 100th part of the same assurance about H," he wrote. "There is no answer. Only the locked door, the iron curtain, the vacuum, absolute zero." He is angry at God and distressed when offered Christian consolations. He's angry at himself for having such a weak faith before Joy died, for being self-centered in his grief, for starting to forget what Joy actually looked like. He fears that he is a source of embarrassment to others. His grief is isolating. He expresses symptoms of acedia, even if it's not acedia, because he's deep in grief. He wrote, "I can't settle down. I yawn. I fidget. I smoke too much. Up till this, I always had too little time. Now there is nothing but time. Almost pure time. Empty successiveness." He wonders what will follow his grief. Just this apathy, this dead flatness? Does grief finally subside into boredom tinged by faint nausea? Grief feels like suspense. In the end, while we probably shouldn't say his grief is resolved, there is upward movement. You're all making me a little bit nervous, you know, as I'm talking about grief that, you know, I'm making you a little depressed here. His jottings, as he called them, have been a successful defense against total collapse. He no longer meets the locked door when he turns to God. His faith in Christ is being restored. "I can now believe again," he said, "that he has done vicariously whatever can be so done." While there is some recovery, the pain is still there, and sometimes in new ways. But there's a new tone at the end of the book. When asking questions of God, he still gets no answer. But it's a rather special sort of no answer, he explains. It is not the locked door. It is more like a silent, certainly not uncompassionate gaze, as though he shook his head, not in refusal, but waving the question, like, "Peace, child, you don't understand." Like I said, it's a hard read. It's emotionally gut-wrenching, but it does end with some hope. In his introduction to the book, Lewis's stepson, Douglas Gresham, writes, Neither his learning nor his experiences had ever prepared him for the combination of both the great love and the great loss, which is its counterpoint. When I read this, it made perfect sense to me. How could Lewis have been prepared for Joy's death? Yes, he knew it was coming, but it's a unique loss. The writing is so visceral and blunt, and Lewis feels like he was caught off guard by the pain. In regard to his learning, although he would have read about both love and loss in Homer, Virgil, Cicero, Boethius, Chaucer, Dante, Shakespeare, to name a few, there's a significant chasm between the academic and the actual. One example of this gap between the abstract and the real is the difference between Lewis's book, The Problem of Pain, published in 1940, which is an intellectual treatment of the problem of pain, and the flood of emotions that is A Grief Observed. In 1940, Lewis was trying to solve a particular intellectual puzzle, which he explained this way. If God were good, he would wish to make his creatures perfectly happy. And if God were almighty, he would be able to do what he wished. But the creatures are not happy. Therefore, God lacks either goodness or power or both. This is the problem of pain in its simplest form. Lewis explains that this is a particularly Christian problem. In fact, he says Christianity created the problem because Christians believe that God is good and that God is almighty. And Christian teaching assures us that reality is righteous and loving. So how does he solve the problem? Very briefly and very inadequately, I will give you a sketch. First, we recognize that God is omnipotent, but that he also limits himself to allow for human agency. We have to understand that pain and suffering were never God's intention, but the result of the fall. And we should be grateful that we are able to recognize our depravity. We also have to recognize that God's goodness, which is true goodness, is not our goodness. God is not merely concerned with our happiness, that is to say, our pleasure, but with our character. And we need to know that God will use pain to get our attention and to remind us that our real treasure is Christ. Pain and suffering are a part of temporal and spatial creation, and we can have hope in a joyful eternity. Great, problem solved. Phew. Until joy dies, and the problem of pain is no longer academic. In 1940, the problem was intellectual. In 1960, it was personal and emotional. So in A Grief Observed, Lewis poses the problem again, writing, "If God's goodness is inconsistent with hurting us, then either God is not good or there is no God. For in the only life we know, he hurts us beyond our worst fear and beyond all we can imagine." A page later, he writes, "What reason have we, except our own desperate wishes, to believe that God is, by any standard we can conceive, good? Doesn't all the evidence suggest exactly the opposite? What have we to set against it?" In re-engaging the question, the problem of pain, this time as a mourner, not as an intellectual solving a problem, Lewis explains that he wasn't afraid that he would cease to believe in God. Instead, he feared that the real danger is coming to believe such dreadful things about him. "The conclusion I dread is not, so there's no God after all, but so this is what God is really like. Deceive yourself no longer." And in fact, he expressed some very dreadful things about God. He seethed with anger, calling God a cosmic sadist and an eternal vivisector. Shockingly and angrily, he speculates that the being Christ called Father was horribly different from what Jesus had supposed, and that the Father had in fact baited a trap for the Son, which was sprung on the cross as a vile practical joke. It's no wonder that some readers of A Grief Observed concluded that Lewis had lost his faith entirely. If you read to the end, I don't think you can have that conclusion. Now, I don't know if this fits the area of learning, but in Lewis's literary, imaginative, and intellectual work, The Chronicles of Narnia, he provides evidence that he thought deeply and theologically about grief. His Narnian writings recognize that grief is real and painful, but also that we have a high priest who can sympathize with us. In The Silver Chair, at the death of King Caspian, Lewis wrote, "And there, on the golden gravel of the bed of the stream, like King Caspian, dead, with the water flowing over him like liquid glass, his long white beard swayed in the water like weed, and all here stood and wept, even the lion. Great lion tears, each tear more precious than the earth would be if it was a single solid diamond." In The Magician's Nephew, as Diggory looks to Aslan to help his mother, Lewis writes, "Up till then, Diggory had been looking at the lion's great feet and huge claws on them. Now, in his despair, he looked up at its face. What he saw surprised him as much as anything in his whole life. For the tawny face was bent down near his own, and wonder of wonders, great shining tears stood in the lion's eyes. They were such big, bright tears compared with Diggory's own that for a moment he felt as if the lion must be sorrier about his mother than he was himself. My son," said Aslan, "I know. Grief is great. Only you and I in this land know that yet. Let us be good to one another." In those works, Lewis seemed to comprehend deeply how compassionate Christ is, how much the suffering Savior suffers alongside his children. A a high priest who sympathizes us with us in our weakness. But none of this seems to have prepared him for his own grief. And a grief observed, Lewis dismissed similar consolations and assurances when a friend reminded him that Christ had also cried out, "Why hast thou forsaken me?" "I know," Lewis wrote. Does that make it any easier to understand? A little further, he would write, "Don't come talking to me about the consolations of religion, or I shall suspect that you don't understand." The academic, the intellectual, the theological fell apart in the face of his own loss. He wrote, "I knew already that these things, and worse, happened daily. I would have said that I had taken them into account. I had been warned. I had warned myself not to reckon on worldly happiness. We were even promised sufferings. They were part of the program. We were even told, 'Blessed are they that mourn.' And I accepted it. I've got nothing I hadn't bargained for." Of course, it is different when the thing happens to oneself, not to others. In reality, not in imagination. But of course, it had happened to him. He had experienced his share of grief. But were those experiences of grief any kind of preparation? When Lewis was only 9 years old, his mother died of cancer, an event that marked not only his life, but his understanding of reality. In Surprised by Joy, his autobiography, he wrote, "With my mother's death, all settled happiness, all that was tranquil and reliable, disappeared from my life." While he denied that God's apparent failure to answer his prayers to save his mother had any real religious significance in his life, one can't help but think it might have planted the seeds of skepticism. After all, it wasn't too long afterward, as a young teenager, that he began to have what he called atheistical thoughts. And by the age of 15, he was denying the existence of God. Now, after years of reflection and in light of his conversion, he wrote that he was at this time living like so many atheists and anti-theists in a whirl of contradictions. "I maintained that God did not exist. I was also angry with God for not existing. I was equally angry with him for creating a world." Although he's almost dismissive of his wartime experience, death and loss were all around him in World War I. He served in the trenches on the Western Front, specifically at the Somme, where he lost comrades and friends. Following the war, back at Oxford, there were constant reminders of the young men who died during the war. Memorials like this one at New College, Oxford, sprang up everywhere, not just at Oxford, but in England. The lists of names of the boys who lost their lives in the war were everywhere. No one could avoid the reminders. Now, parenthetically, it was also during the war, while convalescing in a hospital, that Lewis read works by Christian authors like George MacDonald and G.K. Chesterton, entirely jeopardizing his atheism. He wrote, "In reading Chesterton, as in reading MacDonald, I did not know what I was letting myself in for. A young man who wishes to remain a sound atheist cannot be too careful of his reading." During the 1920s at Oxford, Lewis made Christian friends and was apparently shocked that they were not only smart, but interesting. It was also during these years, informed by friends like J.R.R. Tolkien and Hugo Dyson, as well as by serious reading and reason, that Lewis first converted to theism and then to Christianity. The Second World War brought more pain, more suffering, more loss. It was all around him. Only days after VE Day, at the end of the war, his good friend Charles Williams died. One biographer described it as a crushing blow for Lewis. So his personal experiences did include loss, death, and grief. Nonetheless, going back to Douglas Gresham, it makes sense that none of this could have prepared Lewis for the death of his wife, Joy. This was, after all, a different kind of relationship. Tolkien called it a very strange relationship. There's the happy couple. The romance was unexpected, and the circumstances surrounding it rather intense. Joy Davidman was 16 years Lewis's junior. She was an American, a New Yorker. She was from the Bronx. At the risk of alienating many of you, go Yankees. We're mentioning the Bronx, for goodness sake, so. She was well-educated, a poet, a magazine editor, and for a short stint, an unsuccessful writer in Hollywood. She, like Lewis, had an atheist phase. Hers included joining the American Communist Party. She returned to New York and married William Gresham in 1942, and they had two sons, David and Douglas. It was a difficult marriage. And during one period of struggle, she turned to religion, exploring the options, and eventually converted to Christianity. Lewis's works on Christianity encouraged and inspired her. So she wrote letters and began corresponding with him in 1950. And he corresponded back with her. In 1952, she traveled to England to meet and befriend Lewis. Bear in mind, she was still married to William Gresham at this point. The marriage wasn't good. It does make the Lewis-Davidman relationship seem very strange indeed. Tolkien was onto something. Early in 1953, she returned to the United States. She met with William, and they agreed to divorce. By November of 1953, she was back in England and had moved into a place close to the Kilns, Lewis's home in Oxford. According to one biographer, it was at this time there was a new momentum in the relationship between Davidman and Lewis. She was funny, good company, intellectually stimulating. She also encouraged his writing. The relationship between Lewis and Joy took a turn when her permit to reside in England neared its expiration in 1956. How could this situation be settled so that Joy could stay in England? A marriage of convenience seemed a reasonable solution to both Lewis and Davidman. For Lewis, who was a student of medieval literature, this was an act of chivalrous generosity. But it wasn't an act of romantic love. On April 23rd, 1956, they married in a civil ceremony. A church wedding would have suggested it was the real thing. A more radical change to their relationship would take place a few months later in October, when Joy was diagnosed with cancer. At this point, Lewis's attitude changed, and he realized he might actually be in love with his wife. In a 1957 letter to Dorothy Sayers, he wrote, "My feelings had changed. They say a rival often turns a friend into a lover. Thanatos, who is the Greek personification of death, Thanatos is a most efficient rival for this purpose. We soon learn to love what we know we must lose." Lewis made a great effort at this point to Christianize the marriage. And on March 21st, 1957, at the hospital, the marriage was solemnized by an Anglican priest. I can only imagine the intensity of emotions in a romance that started under such unusual and urgent circumstances. An imminent death, revealing a romantic love, and the expectation of a brief married life. Joy's cancer did appear to go in remission in 1958, but returned in October 1959. On July 13th, 1960, with Lewis at her bedside, she died. So as I read A Grief Observed, in all of its raw, shocking candor, Douglas Gresham's point that neither learning nor experience had prepared Lewis still made sense to me. Reading about loss and grief, thinking deeply and rationally about the problem of pain, mourning family and friends, had not prepared Lewis to grieve for joy. And then I read the last line of A Grief Observed. Poi si torno all'eterna fontana. The Italian sentence challenged everything that I had thought to that point. Maybe Lewis was better prepared than Gresham or I had thought. This line is from Paradiso, the last book of Dante's Divine Comedy. Then she turned back to the eternal fountain. It's the moment when Beatrice, Dante's beloved and guide through heaven, paradise, leaves him to finish the journey to God on his own. Is A Grief Observed a retelling of the Divine Comedy? I mean, Lewis did love the poem. Is A Grief Observed more than a mere eruption of uncontrolled emotions? Did Lewis have more in mind when writing this book than catharsis? As I reflected on it, it certainly seemed to be the case. I could see a resemblance between Divine Comedy, although it is like 1,000 pages longer. I could see the resemblance between the Divine Comedy and A Grief Observed. Like Dante, Lewis descends lower and lower toward despair. And then he turns a corner and moves toward hope. And then I found an account of Walter Hooper's first reading of A Grief Observed. Hooper was a friend and confidant of Lewis toward the end of Lewis's life. He would become an editor of Lewis's books and produced a fair amount of scholarship on Lewis. In recounting his first reading of A Grief Observed, which took place in 1963, Hooper says that Lewis asked him to go up to the bedroom and bring down a book entitled A Grief Observed by N.W. Clarke. Lewis told Hooper that he had written the book and wanted Hooper to read it so that he could watch his reaction to it. So Lewis leaned back in his chair, lit his pipe, and watched Hooper read. This is sort of a reverse of the Oxford-Cambridge style of tutoring, where the student brings in a paper to the tutor and gives it to the tutor and watches the tutor read. It's just a really difficult, awkward thing, just watching someone read and react to your paper. You know, making faces. And there's a great story of Lewis when a student brought a paper to him and was sitting there, and Lewis is just reading the paper silently, not reacting, and finally picks up, turns to the student with the paper and says, "Good word." And that was it. That's all he said. But from Lewis, that was high praise. So Lewis watched Hooper read A Grief Observed. When Hooper reached the point where Lewis described God as a cosmic sadist and eternal vivisector, he said, "Good heavens, Jack, you've lost the faith." Lewis said, "Read on, read on." Lewis continued to watch Hooper read until he finished the book and saw how the argument against the goodness of God had been completely resolved in the fourth part. At which point, Lewis told Hooper, "The structure of it is based on Dante's Divine Comedy. You go down and down and down. Then, as in Dante, when you hit bottom, and past Lucifer's waist, you go up to a defense of God's goodness. A grief observed was not simply the emotional ramblings of a grieving widower. Lewis had intended all along to follow the pattern of the great Italian poem. So let me suggest that Lewis's learning had, maybe, at least to a degree, prepared him to mourn. Now, for those who haven't read the Divine Comedy in a while, let me remind you of a few things. It was written between 1308 and 1321 AD. It's a long poem. It did take all that time to write it. The poem begins with Dante in despair over the loss of Beatrice. Here are the first few lines. Midway on our life's journey, I went astray from the straight road and woke to find myself alone in a dark wood. How shall I say what wood that was? I never saw so drear, so rank, so arduous a wilderness. Its very memory gives shape to fear. Death could scarce be more bitter than that place, but since it came to good, I will recount all that I found revealed there by God's grace. Through Inferno, the most famous part of the Divine Comedy, the Roman poet Virgil serves as Dante's guide. He brings him deeper and deeper through the nine levels of hell. When Dante reaches the lowest level, he sees Lucifer trapped waist deep in ice. Hell is the furthest place you can get from God and from the warmth of God's love. So it's cold, not hot. At that point, Dante's journey turns upward. He's reached the center of the earth, and now, as he continues on, he's rising to the other side of the world where he reaches the mountain of purgatory. This part of the journey is told in the book Purgatory. It's a time of cleansing and purging and preparation for heaven. When Dante reaches heaven, the third book, Paradiso, the pagan poet Virgil has to leave. He is not, after all, a Christian. But Dante's beloved, Beatrice, appears as his new guide. She takes him as far into heaven as possible. But in the end, Dante must finish the journey toward God on his own. I think we can see this structure and some of the themes in A Grief Observed. Lewis is not unlike Dante in his despairing bereavement over his beloved, or in losing his way in a dark wood. He descends, but also rises, and lives to tell about it for the sake of others. One more thing, although probably not the only thing, Beatrice needs to teach Dante not to idolize her. This is one of the reasons she leaves him. God alone is worthy of our worship. This is a lesson that Lewis is also learning by the end of A Grief Observed. Lewis calls God the great iconoclast, destroying images and idols. His grief has been a temptation to idolize joy. He wonders if he must learn to love God so much that he doesn't care whether or not he will see joy again in order to see joy again. His loves need to be rightly ordered. He realizes at the end what he needs is not my idea of God, but God. Not my idea of H, but H. These are not dissimilar conclusions to those he came up with in The Problem of Pain, but they are more personal. As I began to see Dante in A Grief Observed, I also started to see more influences in the book. Like Augustine in Confessions, Lewis questions his motives for his grief. Is he mourning for the right reasons? Is his grief self-centered? We can also see the language of lament that we see in the Psalms. Lewis wants to know why God is silent. The opening verse of Psalm 83 reads, "O God, do not keep silence. Do not hold your peace or be still, O God." In the first week of this lecture series, we received a handout giving us direction should we want to write our own lament. And there were prompts for sentences. Why? How long? I had hoped, but the reality is, I've lost. I'm afraid. Will you please? All of these, in different forms, can be found in A Grief Observed. Lewis had absorbed the Psalms. He read them daily, so they came out of him in his mourning. Does all of this mean that Lewis was in fact prepared for his grief? I don't know. In one sense, no. Who can be prepared? Having the Divine Comedy in mind as he wrote certainly doesn't mean that the emotions that he expressed weren't genuine, that there wasn't real pain, real agony, real struggle, that there weren't real questions and doubts, and that there wasn't a crisis of faith. It did give a structure. Maybe it's better to say a map for Lewis's own grief. When the time for the passage into depths of grief came, although the journey had to be his, Lewis could, like Dante turning to Virgil, turn to his own guides, Augustine or David or Dante. Following Jim's example from last week, allow me to end with a poem written by C.S. Lewis. It's called Loves as Warm as Tears. Loves as warm as tears. Love is tears. Pressure within the brain, tension at the throat. Deluge, weeks of rain, haystacks afloat. Featureless seas between hedges where once was green. Love's as fierce as fire. Love is fire. All sorts. Infernal heat clinkered with greed and pride. Lyric desire, sharp, sweet. Laughing, even when denied. And that imperial flame whence all love came. Love's as fresh as spring. Love is spring. Birdsong in the air. Cool smells in a wood. Whispering, dare, dare. To sap to blood, telling ease, safety, rest are good, not best. Love's as hard as nails. Love is nails. Blunt, thick, hammered through the medial nerves of one who, having made us, knew the thing he had done, seeing what all that is, our cross and his. Thank you.